Sounds True presents The Isaiah Effect by Greg Braden, narrated by the author.
Almost universally, the writings of ancient peoples and indigenous traditions remind us of a tremendous force that lives within each of us. It is this power, they say, that allows us to become more than the great challenges of our time, transcending our greatest adversity with grace and ease. They invite us to allow for the possibility that it is in the moments of the great challenges of life that we may become more than those challenges, more than just the survival, actually transcending what it is that those challenges have meant to us in the past. It is through this power, they say, that we speak to the forces of creation and to the world around us, from the most distant points of the cosmos to our everyday world and even to one another. Could such a power exist? Is there a lost science that enables us to heal our bodies, to bring a lasting peace to our world and avert the greatest tragedies ever to face humankind? 2,500-year-old texts and now our own science suggest that the answer to this question is a resounding yes. So I'd like to share a story with you regarding this power that lives within us as an illustration of what we will tie into as we come back to this again and again and again. It's a story that happens with me in the late 1990s in Northern California. I was preparing for a program the following day, and I had just had dinner with friends in a restaurant on the seaside in Northern California. I left the table a little early that night and just wanted to be alone. As I was walking down the hallway, my eyes noticed a man who was selling jewelry. It was Tibetan jewelry, and I think perhaps maybe that's why I was so drawn to him. And I engaged him in conversation, and very quickly we found a friendship, a kinship, a bond that had developed between us. And our conversation turned away from his jewelry to children. And he was surrounded by three of the most beautiful children that I had ever seen. They were his own, and he said he had a fourth that would be joining us shortly. And I shared with him that I had never had the opportunity to know children in my life. My wife and I have never had the privilege and the honor of bringing life into this world in that way. And a gleam came into his eye, and he very proudly shared with me. He said, "You know, my hands were the first hands that touched each of my children when they came into this world. I was the midwife for each of my children." And he said, "When a child is ready to come into this world, it's a very easy process, very quick." And he made a motion as if he were catching a football coming from a quarterback in a football game. He said, "They shoot right into the world effortlessly." And I remember thinking to myself, "That's easy for you to say. I'm wondering what your wife would say in this moment." And all of a sudden, something changed. There was a stillness that came over him, and I knew that something key was about to happen. He began sharing with me the story of the last birth. He said, "Generally, the birth is easy, and something happened with this last one." He said, "When my wife began her labor pains, and our last son was being birthed into this world, it began just as every other birth had. And then all of a sudden, something changed. Everything stopped. Everything absolutely stopped." And he said, "It's funny where our mind goes in moments like that." He said, "My mind raced back to a time where I had read in a Chicago Police Department manual, an operations manual for emergency childbirth." And he said that the manual stated that every once in a while during birth, it's not uncommon that their head or their shoulder blades become lodged in the tailbone of the mother. And it's a relatively simple procedure to dislodge that child and to bring the birth to fruition. And in that moment, I reached with my hand inside of my wife and I felt her tailbone. And sure enough, right next to her tailbone was the shoulder of my unborn son. And just as I was preparing to move him away from the tailbone, the most amazing thing happened. He said, "I felt the hand of my unborn son reach up past my hand and touch the tailbone of his mother and push himself away to free himself. And as his arm brushed my arm, there was a pause just for a moment, as if he were trying to understand what it was that had just happened. And then I felt his tiny fingers wrap around my hand. And I felt the hand of my unborn son inside of my wife. And I knew in that moment that he would be okay. And the three of us worked together to bring him into this world. I took a deep breath. I felt the feeling, the intensity, the emotion of the moment. And I know that when I share that story, that intensity, that emotion carries through. And the reason I share it with you now is because it is in the emotion of what we feel hearing a story like that. The point of that emotion is a doorway to the great possibilities in our lives to allow us to touch creation in ways that we have only dreamed of in the past. This is the power that the ancients remind us of. In the only words they knew, in the language of their time, 2,500-year-old texts remind us that there is such a power that lives within us. And in very eloquent words, these poets as well as scientists remind us that the key to this power is in our understanding that the world that we see around us is a mirror. It's a reflection of the feelings and the beliefs that live within us. Very simple, very eloquent, perhaps deceptively simple. Such a perspective views the events of our world as a barometer of sorts. The events of the world around us allow us to gauge the consequences of the choices, the beliefs, and the values that we have in each moment of our lives. The implications of such a perspective are vast, empowering, and I've discovered to some people even a little frightening. The implication that somehow the events unfolding in the world around us are in any way whatsoever related to what's happening inside of our bodies, and perhaps taking it one step further, the implication that we may choose to participate in those events around us by changing what happens in our bodies. In such a view, the chaos of a changing world, for example, the violence in our families, our communities, even the unsettled patterns of nature, such as the rogue weather patterns that we've seen in the last decades of the 20th century, are seen as mirrors of anger, rage, jealous competition, and hate that we harbor from within. Now, I have to say, in my training in the hard sciences, I have no training, no formal training that prepares me to understand relationships of this nature, on the one hand. On the other hand, the same view suggests that as we heal the personal challenges in our own lives, the challenges that we face day in and day out, through forgiveness, understanding, tolerance, and compassion, that our outer world reflects those choices as well. We may well expect to see changes in the outer world based on our ability to become understanding and compassion within. We may expect to see the great changes in the world around us as subtle and gentle patterns of change. Through these understandings, we're just beginning to recognize two very powerful technologies that allow us to determine, number one, the condition of our bodies, number two, the future of our world in ways perhaps that we've only dreamed of in the past. The first science, the science of prophecy allowing us to witness future consequences of choices that we are making in our lives in the present. The second is the technology of prayer. And I'll be even more specific, perhaps modalities of prayer that we are just beginning to understand that allow us to choose which of those future prophecies we live in our personal lives, day in and day out, collectively, as a world. If such a power exists, we must ask ourselves this question. If it does exist, this inner technology, where is it today? Is it possible that an event has occurred somewhere in our past, in the midst of our ancient memory, that left a gap in our knowledge, perhaps of how we relate to our world, the cosmos, and even one another? Well, almost universally, ancient texts, ancient traditions suggest that from the first moment that the first human walked this earth and lifted their eyes to the heavens, that the information, the secrets of the cosmos have always resided with us. They live with us. They live among us in this world. That information was given to those who walk this earth by those who have come before us. Scholars today, however, openly acknowledge a time in our own history when tremendous amounts of information, perhaps containing that knowledge, disappeared from the open literature. The books, the texts, the libraries where we had always gone to remind ourselves of this power that walks the earth and lives as us. 1,700 years ago, key elements of our ancient heritage were edited from the libraries of their time, of that day. The information was relegated to the esoteric traditions, elite priesthoods, and the mystery schools and sacred orders. From that moment forward, generation by generation by generation, our memory of this power that lives within us began to wane to the point where now it appears as sometimes fairy tales and dreams and wishes of the way we would like to relate to the world around us and the power we wish that we had within us. Well, what our scholars openly acknowledge is that at least 25 books, for example, were taken from what today we call our biblical texts. This was done by a recommendation of the Council of Nicaea in the 4th century. We discussed this in more detail in other programs. So I'll just be very brief here and say that it is this kind of information, when it was lost, that began to imply that we are separate from our world, separate from the forces of the cosmos and one another. Even today, many of our scientific principles, spiritual practices, our history, our lineage of wisdom, who we are, where we come from, how we relate to one another, are based not in something that's wrong, however, in something that is incomplete, in incomplete understandings of our most ancient heritage. Perhaps some of the clearest records of these lost texts, specifically our spiritual sciences, began to reappear near the middle of the 20th century when they were discovered in a series of desert caves located near the ancient city of Jerusalem. Today we know this area as the Dead Sea, and in some places unlikely as a desert 1,300 feet below sea level in the desolate and arid deserts along the Dead Sea, we find a series of caves. And it is within these caves that our story begins. And it's an amazing story that begins with a young Bedouin boy in 1946 herding sheep along the sheer cliff faces, just as the people and his family had done for generations and generations. And on this day, this young boy did something different. He picked up a handful of stones. He threw them into one of the caves, apparently something he had done many times in the past. On this day, however, he threw them into a different cave, and when the stones entered the cave, instead of hitting a rock floor, he heard something different. Something broke inside of that cave. He heard something shatter. Well, it frightened him. He ran back at dusk to his parents the next morning. They went back to this cave. They explored the entrance to the cave. It was so small that they had to crawl in on their hands and knees, and what they found were a series of clay vases, and it is these vases that the stones had struck and had shattered. Inside of these vases were the remnants of a library that was stored in this place over 2,000 years ago. The vases were sealed with resin and straw, effectively keeping the moisture and the elements away from these texts, preserving them so that we may see them today. Well, this was the beginning of a saga that continues until this moment, a saga that we now call the story of the Dead Sea Scrolls. And it is within these scrolls that we are beginning to find and fill in the missing pieces to complete our history and our heritage. What we now know is that there were many scrolls in a number of caves. They were created on parchment, paper, and papyrus. They were created on animal hides. Some of them were actually created on metallic surfaces, such as very finely hammered copper. And as these copper scrolls that were so brittle, entire new technologies had to be created so that we could saw these scrolls open strip by strip, and for the first time glimpse the writing, the impressions through the hand of the authors of these ancient texts, the first time in over 2,500 years. Between 1946 and 1959, in this area that we now know as Qumran, on the shores of the Dead Sea, 11 caves were discovered. In those 11 caves, over 25,000 fragments of papyrus, animal hide, some metallic fragments, were discovered, some of them no more than maybe an inch square. Many of them were simply lying loose on the floor of these caves. These fragments comprised at least 800 scrolls, and those scrolls now and the fragments were all taken into an area, the Rockefeller Museum, just outside of Jerusalem, in an area that's known as the Scrollery, where a team of 8 scholars were given the task of assembling these fragments, translating the texts, compiling the information, and distributing it to the public. And this is an ongoing task today. The scrolls were deposited by a mysterious group that we know today as the Ancient Essenes. And I say mysterious because we don't know a lot about where the Essenes came from. They first appear in the Qumran area around 500 years before the time of Christ. They disappear in the first century after the crucifixion. The Essenes separated themselves from the communities of their time to live the truth, what they felt was the truth, of a lineage of wisdom that has been on this earth for over 4,000 years before the time of Christ. Over 6,000 years ago, this wisdom first appears. And we find elements of the Essene wisdom in every major religion and belief system, even those who are no longer in existence, and including those still in the earth today, the Buddhist traditions, the Islamic traditions, the Christian traditions, the Jewish traditions, native and indigenous traditions, as different as they all appear today, there are common threads, elements that run between them that are all traced back to the wisdom of the ancient Essenes. The texts that we found were in a number of languages. Some of them were in some of the oldest Hebrew known today, in a form known as ancient Hebrew. Other texts were in more modern languages that we do recognize today, such as more modern Hebrew, Aramaic. We also find Greek texts as well. One of the reasons that the discovery of these scrolls is so key is because for the first time in these scrolls, we began to fill in the missing pieces that were lost to us 1,700 years ago. It was in these caves, when this library was hidden, that the complete elements of that library were stored away for safekeeping before the great edits of the 4th century. For example, one of the first texts that we were able to see was what we now know is the original book of Genesis. The book of Genesis that we have today is accurate, however, it is incomplete. The original book is much more comprehensive. We find information about the Essenes themselves in the text called the Manual of Discipline. And it's through the Manual of Discipline that we know of their belief systems and their worldview and their insights that allows us to make sense out of the text that they left to us, as well as relatively mysterious texts describing a war between what they call the sons of darkness and the sons of light that plays out throughout time, and how our lives revolve around that battle between the sons of darkness and the sons of light. It is in the recovery of these texts now that we begin to find the value and gain the insights into the relevance of their wisdom, the Essene traditions, even in the presence of our very modern, highly sophisticated technological societies today. The Essenes were saying something to us then, 2,500 years ago, that has tremendous relevance in our lives today. Perhaps one of the best ways to understand what they were saying to us is to speak briefly and very non-technically about what we call the physics of time. There is another common thread that we find as we go through ancient and indigenous traditions, And that thread is simply this, that those who have come before us viewed our relationship to time very differently than we view our relationship to time today. In the words of their time, they remind us that the healing within our bodies, whether or not we age or how we deteriorate as we go through our lives, and how we relate to the events that unfold in our world, are all very closely linked to how we perceive time in our world today. In the Four Corners area of northern New Mexico, 430 feet above the desert floor, is a butte that is known as Fajada Butte. It is one part of the technology and the civilization that was left behind by the mysterious Chacoans, the indigenous peoples that settled Chaco Canyon nearly 1,000 years ago. It is on the top of this butte that we find today a mystery, what many archaeologists in North America are calling the North American Stonehenge. At the top of Fajada Butte, we find a series of 3 vertical stone slabs, and although they look very natural, what we know is that each one is carefully fashioned by hand and positioned precisely in a very specific manner. If we look behind these stones, what we find is on the flat surface, behind the stones, a series of spirals. They were arranged in such a way, the vertical slabs, so that when the sun shines through and in between the slabs on very particular days of the year, it casts particular forms of light onto the spiral rocks. And we call this the sun dagger. The sun dagger effect shines through the rocks on the longest day of the year and on the shortest day of the year. The mathematics to create this North American Stonehenge are so sophisticated that researchers were reluctant to even acknowledge that Native North American peoples had this technology until 1979, and now that they do recognize what it is off limits to the public. We see this only through photographs and through documentaries. And what this is showing us, this North American Stonehenge, is that these peoples were very adept at measuring time as it passes us by, much the way we do with our calendars today. The same kind of time measurements we find in other traditions of the world, such as the zodiac calendar on the ceiling in the temple of Dendera in Egypt, the circular calendar containing all of the original zodiac signs, the first time we've seen all these symbols together as a zodiac calendar. These are examples of the ancient traditions, again, of measuring time as it's passing us by, viewing us as witnesses, as observers of something happening around us. Well, as good as those calendars are, we also know that the ancients had very different insights into time as well. In 1999, I had the opportunity to facilitate a pilgrimage into Egypt, one of the many times that we have been to this very beautiful, very sacred land. However, this time we were allowed to go in places that some of them I've never been before. One particular location was a temple outside of Luxor, Egypt, about 90 miles outside of Luxor on the West Bank, a temple dedicated to the study of time. To the best of my knowledge, this is the only temple that I've seen, certainly anywhere in Egypt, perhaps anywhere in the world, dedicated to time and the study of time in the manner with which I'm going to describe, because rather than measuring time as it passes us by, this temple very clearly is dedicated to our ability to move through time, to project our awareness, to move our consciousness through time, not as bystanders, rather to participate in the process of time as it's unfolding. Now, this is a very different viewpoint of our relationship to time that's very empowering. We're going to tie into this in just a few moments. On the temple walls of the surrounding sites, we find deeply inscribed hieroglyphs and paintings Some of them so brilliant it's as if the artist left only moments earlier. They have been so perfectly preserved. And what they show us is that we are so closely related to the process of time that we are literally navigating time throughout our entire existence upon this earth, whether we are aware of it or not. Quantum physics today, and I'll define quantum physics briefly, quantum science is the study of non-physical forces whose movements create our physical world. Unseen forces that touch the elements of the world around us and have an effect day in and day out. Quantum physics today, and some of our best physicists are beginning to look at time in ways that perhaps we have not seen since the time of the ancients. Albert Einstein, for example, in the brilliance and the simplicity of his own language, said to us that time is not at all what it seems. Time does not flow in only one direction, and the future exists simultaneously with the past. That is quite a statement for a 20th century physicist to be able to say. It opens the door to tremendous possibilities. When I was in school and when I was studying the sciences the way they're taught today, I was taught that time moves in two directions. It moves forward and it moves behind us. So we have a future and we have a past. Science now allows for time to exist in three directions rather than simply those two. Our own science now suggests that we do have time that moves horizontally into our future. We call that forward time. Time that moves horizontally behind us into our past, we call that reverse time. And the third component of time is now called vertical time. Vertical time. What vertical time says to us, it opens the door for the possibilities that time has a beginning, time has an end, and vertical time says that time exists as layers. And this is where our discussion gets very, very interesting. Time exists as layers. For every moment in our lives, vertical time says in that precise moment, there are other moments that are playing out in the same instant. We may or may not be aware of them in that moment. It says for every instance, for example, of life-threatening conditions of disease and illness, or the global atrocities of suffering in other nations, in that same instant, there is a point in time where none of those things ever occurred, where our bodies are completely healed and where peace and cooperation have occurred among nations. Our own science now says that all of these are existing at the same point in time. Vertical time allows for many possible outcomes for any given moment in time. And this is going to give us some tremendous insight into our exploration of the ancient science of prophecy. As the prophets looked from their point in history along the layers of time to our time and perhaps even into our future, what was it that they were seeing? What were they saying to us? And what does it mean? What can we learn from what those prophets were sharing in the only language of their time? Can we use their insight and bring that to bear upon the conditions of our world? Some of the conditions of what many researchers and scientists and lay people alike believe represent some of the most frightening conditions ever to face humankind. Can we participate, perhaps, rather than changing those conditions, in choosing new outcomes so that those conditions never even come to pass? Could vertical time be the condition that accounts for our missing universe? This is very interesting. In my time in the academic profession and in many papers and texts, life scientists and physical scientists have very interesting statistics that they use to show us how we relate to our world. Many of the listeners have probably heard of this before. For example, we've all heard it said that 90% of our brain is unused, that we only use 10% of our brain. And there are all kinds of theories about what that other 90% may be used for. And I know I heard this a lot when I was a young boy in school, and when my parents, for example, felt like I wasn't applying myself the way I should in my studies. They were talking about all the 90% of my brain that I could be using while I was only using that 10%. Well, this is interesting because physical scientists, physicists, for example, in their view of the creation of our universe, have very similar statistics for the universe. Researchers believe that on very sophisticated computers, we can actually model the moment that creation began, what some researchers call the Big Bang. And from that moment, in the simulations, in the models of the Big Bang, when we run the simulations out, something very fascinating as well as unexplained occurs within the first few seconds after the beginning of creation. Scientists find that 90% of creation disappears in the models. We can't account for it. And there are articles in magazines and scientific and tech journals that actually say 90% of the universe is missing. They're saying, where is it? Well, scientists have come up with a term called dark matter. It's this stuff that appears to be in between the nothingness of the cosmos, although we cannot see it directly. We can see its effects through gravity and magnetics on celestial bodies around it. What is this dark matter? This is one of the great mysteries of physics. Could the concept of vertical time and many possibilities playing out, could that attribute to the condition that we account for in our missing universe? In other words, is it possible that from the moment that creation began, as it began to expand very quickly, if in fact we did have this Big Bang, the 90% of creation that disappears has vibrated itself so quickly, it has vibrated beyond the realm of our senses and our machines into what we now know as higher dimensional state spaces. Well, this is precisely now what our own quantum science, our own physics, is beginning to suggest, that there are many dimensions of our experience, many dimensions of our reality. They all coexist simultaneously. They're all playing out in this very moment. And that perhaps that dark matter that we can see the effects of is where these other experiences and where these other dimensions live in our world. If so, this opens the door to a tremendous possibility of how we relate to the world around us as well as to the cosmos. Stephen Hawking, one of the most renowned physicists of modern times, has actually said in very recent years, quantum science, quantum mechanics, does not predict a single definite result or an outcome for an observation. We can't tell you precisely what's going to happen in a given point in time. Instead, quantum science predicts a number of different possible outcomes first, and then it tells us how likely each outcome might be. Quantum science is saying there are many possible outcomes for any given situation. This is precisely what the ancients were saying to us, I believe, in the words of their time, as they were sharing their insights into our future, their prophecies. They were showing us many, many different possibilities and saying to us, this is what we have seen in your future. And then they were even taking us one step further. They were showing us how to participate in choosing which future plays out in our world. For all possibilities to be present in the moment, two conditions must already be in place. One, that means that every possibility must already exist. We have heard time and time again that we create our reality. I know that we've all heard that many, many times. Quantum science says that's close. It's not quite accurate. Rather than creating the reality, quantum science says that all possibilities, all realities are already created. That every eventuality, every condition, every outcome of every relationship and experience that we could ever think of, it's already there in vertical time. Secondly, for these conditions to be present, it says that every possibility must occupy the same place in the same instant of time. Well, think about what this means. How is it, if all of these possibilities all exist in the same moment of time, how can they be in the same place in the same time without bumping into each other, My physics taught me that two things cannot be in the same place in the same instant of time because there's only space for one at a time. However, our new physics, quantum physics, now is saying something very, very different. Now, I could not have even said this until 1998 when some of these experiments were actually reported in the open literature. I could not have shared this information. Quantum science, under laboratory conditions, has now created the temperatures and the pressures where two atoms in very different places may be brought together and occupy the same space in the same moment, in the same instant of time, without bumping into one another. Two somethings at the same place in the same time. What our science traditionally has said could not happen. Now, under laboratory conditions anyway, we know that there are certain conditions where this may come to pass. Well, for physicists, for scientists, this opens the door to a tremendous and vast array of possibilities. The world around us is made of many, many atoms. The events of our lives, the people, the experiences that we have, they are all made of atoms coming together. If atoms may share the same place at the same time under the right conditions in the laboratory, then perhaps it is a matter of scale, and the same thing can happen in the world around us. The question is, how do those conditions come to pass? And do we have any ability to participate in creating these conditions? How does this relate to us? The conditions where two pieces of matter may occupy the same place in the same instant of time actually has a name. It is called a Bose-Einstein condensate. In their laboratory conditions, up to 16 million atoms of the element beryllium have been merged into the same place, the same time, a single existence, creating a form of matter so large that it can be photographed, it can be measured, it can be weighed. So we know that this is possible. If it's possible in the laboratory, perhaps it's possible in our world as well. Well, what does this mean? What is the purpose of talking about different forms of matter occupying the same place at the same time? This goes back to our discussion of vertical time. If in one instant of our lives, one moment of time in our day, many, many, many possibilities are all playing out at the same time, we certainly are not aware of them. They may be dormant in our awareness until we awaken them through conditions in our lives. What this says is that for every instance of global warfare, or atrocity, or suffering, or injustice against the peoples of this world, there is another possibility where that never happened. For every moment an individual is diagnosed with a potentially life-threatening condition of cancer, or HIV, or some of the new viruses that are being discovered in our world right now, what it says is there's another condition where that never happened. Perhaps this gives insight into some of the mysterious writings of some of our most ancient and sacred traditions that say to us about our healing that we are already healed. We simply have to accept it into our lives. That peace has already happened on the planet Earth. We simply have to accept it into our world. Now quantum science is saying there's a good possibility that those conditions are precisely the conditions that are playing out in our world right now. If time exists as these many layers, as vertical time, could the events of our world begin in one layer and arrive at a point in time in the future in a different layer with a different outcome? In other words, is it possible that we may be barreling down a path with tremendous momentum toward one outcome that looks as if it's inevitable and create the conditions to leap, maybe this is the quantum leap, to leap from that outcome into another path where those conditions never occur, where the disease or the illness or the warfare or the hatred or the rage or the severe weather patterns never occur. This is the value, I believe, of understanding this very ancient yet highly sophisticated body of information that suggests not only do we relate to the world around us, that we may participate in determining the outcome of our very future. And that is an empowering sentence to be able to make. When we talk about vertical time and the many opportunities within vertical time, the name given to these possibilities is called parallel possibilities. And this sounds like science fiction, and maybe this is where science fiction comes from. The word parallel possibilities is not new. It was first proposed in 1957 by Dr. Hugh Everett III at Princeton University. In his theories of parallel possibilities, Dr. Everett even gives a name to the moments in time when the course of events may be changed. As we are barreling down this path toward a given outcome, we come to key points in time where the course of an event may be changed. He calls those choice points. And what Dr. Everett says is that within the many possibilities of time, it is not only possible, it is likely that we may move from one path or one course of events unto another. The ancients say precisely the same thing. They say that we do it all the time, that we do it effortlessly, so much so we may not even recognize when we do it or how we do it. For example, many of you have probably heard of seemingly miraculous healings within individuals where they have been diagnosed with a potentially life-threatening tumor, for example. The day of the surgery, the confirmation x-ray shows that the tumor has disappeared. Well, medical science calls that a miracle. It may be a miracle because it may be involving relationships between us and our physical world that we do not account for in our current models of science. And I'd like to be very clear on this. I believe our scientific method is very powerful, and if used properly, that our scientific method will tell us about these relationships. Our science, however, and the place where our science investigates is to a large extent governed by our beliefs about how we relate to the world around us. Those beliefs changed 1,700 years ago. So Dr. Everett says that we may in fact have choice points in our personal as well as our collective lives, as individuals and as a world. And this says that each time we perceive that we are moving toward a frightening or a tragic event, what we say is, yes, that may be so, and we know now that it is one and only one of many, many, many possibilities. Quantum science suggests that many possible futures for every moment of our lives exist. Each future, they say now, lies in a state of rest until it's awakened by choices that we make in the present. Do we know how to make those choices? A 2,500-year-old scroll says precisely the same thing. It's suggesting the same principle. Is it possible that the ancient Essenes and even indigenous and ancient traditions before that were sharing in the language of their time what we today recognize as quantum principles? And if so, what may we glean from understanding their worldview through the language of our modern science today? Not only do 2,500-year-old texts and our own science suggest these possibilities exist, through a language we are just beginning to understand, those same texts show us how to participate in choosing our future, how we may determine which of those possibilities plays out in our lives. Each time we choose, each time we consciously look into our future and say, this is what we choose to have in our lives, we experience now what we're calling the Isaiah effect. The reason we call this the Isaiah effect is that perhaps some of the clearest information regarding these principles was first discovered in cave number 1 in 1946 of the Dead Sea Scrolls, When that young Bedouin shepherd boy tossed those stones into that cave, among the first seven scrolls that were found, was the most complete of all of the 800 Dead Sea Scrolls found to date, the scroll of the great prophet Isaiah.
This concludes Side A. Please turn the tape over for Side B.
Now that we recognize that some of our most ancient and sacred texts may have been saying to us, in the only words they knew in the language of their time, that there are in fact many possibilities playing out in each moment of our lives, and now that our own science and the language that we recognize and accept today is saying precisely the same thing, the question becomes, how do we choose? Do we know how to choose between those possibilities? Well, this discussion opens the door to a beautiful, wonderful new interpretation of the science of prophecy and what prophecy may in fact be saying to us today. Quantum concepts of time allow us to view prophecy in a way that we have never suspected in the past. And from this perspective, we have the opportunity to engineer the ideas of prophecy and bring those ideas to bear on the events of our world. For many people I've spoken with, the word prophecy sounds very new age or a new thought, and for them brings a sense of something that's really not believable or doesn't have much science or backbone behind it. Well, the Western world today, our own science and our military take prophecy very seriously, and we have a study of prophecy under a new name. Today we call it remote viewing. Remote viewing may be defined as our ability to project our awareness, our consciousness, and our senses through the layers or the paths of time. Our physical body stays in one place. Our senses move along what the ancients called rivers or roads or waves or ribbons of time. These are some of the ways that time has always been described in these ancient texts. And as our awareness moves either forward, backward, or vertically through time, we have the ability to register what it is that we have seen, what we've smelled, what we have sensed, what we have felt, bring that to the present moment, and record it. So remote viewing is being taken very seriously now by both our science and our military. We began hearing about remote viewing in the early 1970s. It was based in research conducted at Stanford Research Institute, SRI, where receivers would work with sensory impressions. This is very akin to open-eyed dreaming, and there are very specific and very strict protocols that the dreamer goes through. There is a facilitator talking the dreamer through various ways of looking in their open-eyed dream at where their consciousness has traveled. And very specialized training is what it is that sets a remote viewer apart from a casual daydreamer. Remote viewing was used extensively, for example, in the Gulf War in the early 1990s, when in the deserts of Iraq, rather than sending in live troops and risking their lives, remote viewers were able to project their consciousness and narrow down the search windows for where suspected missile sites or POW camps might be, and then the troops could go in with much less risk. So prophecy or remote viewing is actually being entertained as a viable science today. And I share this with you now because it is the same concept, the same prophecy that I believe brings the relevance of these ancient traditions and what the ancients were saying into our modern world today. Perhaps one of the best examples of how the layers of time and the possibilities of prophecy coexist in the same instant of time may be explored is through a phenomenon that we now know as the Bible Code. This is a very non-religious exploration of what mathematicians, statisticians, scientists, and researchers are recognizing as a matrix of information contained within the first five books, and the first five books only, of the Hebrew Bible, the ancient Torah. For hundreds of years, there has been a rumor that has circulated through the clergy and through the monks, the nuns, the scribes who've transcribed biblical texts from generation to generation. And that rumor has been that aside from the words and the outward expression that we read in our biblical text, that there are hidden texts within that text, that they are encoded somehow. If we have the wisdom to recognize the code, we have the wisdom to read deeper meaning into what these biblical texts are saying. Well, to decipher these codes, up until recently, was a manual operation. It was very tedious. It was done by hand over long periods of time. And with the advent of modern computers and high-speed computers, the concept of the Bible code has been taken much farther and explored to the degree that scientists and researchers today are in agreement that there is a phenomenon happening. They may be in disagreement about precisely what that phenomenon is, and they say there's something very unique and very interesting that is happening here. It was in 1995 that the Bible code was brought into public awareness as an instrument of prophecy when it was shown that on November 4th of that year, an event occurred on that day that had been predicted in the biblical text over 3,000 years previously, and that event was the assassination of Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin in the city of Tel Aviv in Israel. The Bible code, as the researchers had been working with the texts, had noted that for particular days, events regarding those days would be noted around that time. Statisticians, mathematicians, and researchers discovered that the Bible code suggested that if Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin, in fact, gave a speech at a particular location on November 4th, moved down a particular street at a particular moment in time, that he would, in fact, lose his life. They shared this with the Israeli officials. The officials were interested. However, they chose not to act on it. And on that day, Yitzhak Rabin was, in fact, assassinated precisely in the manner that the Bible code had predicted. Well, this event is what brought the Bible code to the attention of many lay people and researchers alike, and of the many, many discoveries that were made in the Bible code. It's found that the texts accurately predict with a very high degree of specificity. These aren't just general predictions. World War I, World War II, the countries involved, the years that they entered, the leaders of the countries as they entered and what their political positions were. The Watergate incident here in the United States, the Shoemaker-Levy comet, the assassinations of President John Kennedy as well as Archduke Ferdinand and Yitzhak Rabin. And it's not all about tragedies. The Bible code speaks to us of great people in our past. It describes, for example, that Beethoven and Bach were both composers, and specifically German composers. It says that Rembrandt was a Dutch painter. And it goes on to say very specific things regarding the Gulf War, for example, in 1990, giving precise dates for the Scud missile attacks in Israel on the 18th of January, 1991. The text goes on and on and on. For many researchers, it's a mystery how so much information with such accuracy could be contained in something that they see as limited as the first five books of the Hebrew Bible. Well, to understand how the Bible code works, now that we have the language of time and the relationship between prophecy and physics, we may draw upon those and look at the Bible code in a new way. The Bible code is based upon the first five books of the Hebrew Bible, known as the Torah, and researchers discovered that it is only these five books upon which this code will work. They've tried it with War and Peace, Gone with the Wind, telephone books, Webster's Dictionary. It simply does not work with these other texts. The first five books of the Hebrew Bible also became the first books of the Christian Bible, And it is believed that these texts, although they were given to us, they appear in this world about 3,200 years ago, they have changed very little in the last 1,000 years. Now, this is important because in so many of the translations of our Western Bible, for example, as it's gone through language after language and translation after translation, the information has changed. Words have changed, spellings have changed, entire sentences and concepts, and now we know entire books have been omitted. The Hebrew Torah appears to be precisely today, with just a few minor exceptions, precisely today, it appears to us the way it did at least 1,000 years ago, and we can say that because we have copies of the Torah that are 1,000 years old. And this is interesting, when the scribes were trained and given the task of copying the Torah by hand, they were told that every single letter must be transcribed precisely the way that appears in the original, and changing even one letter ran the risk of bringing doom to the entire earth. And now our understandings of time and prophecy are beginning to shed light on why that kind of information was given to those scribes so long ago. An 18th century scholar known as the Genius of Vilna perhaps best summarized the role that the Torah plays in helping us to understand the possibilities of vertical time in the events of our lives. He says the rule is that all that was, all that is, all that will ever be until the very end of time is included in the Torah, from the first word to the last word, and not merely in a general sense, but as to the details of every species and each individual, and details of details, and everything that has happened to him from the day of his birth until the end. What this quote is suggesting is that the Bible code is a matrix. It's a record of all of the possibilities that could ever play out since the moment that creation began, encoded within this one text. That opens the door to a tremendous and vast array of possibilities. The key to understanding the code within the Bible code is based on something called equidistant letter sequences, or ELS sequences, and it essentially goes like this. It is said in the ancient traditions that the first five books of the Hebrew Bible were given to the people of the earth as one long sentence. So what researchers have done is from the first letter of the first word of the book of Genesis to the last letter of the book of Deuteronomy, they have taken all the spaces, all the punctuation out and made one long sentence and arranged that into a matrix, an array, a very long array that entails all of Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. And it is upon this array of many, many, many letters, over 300,000 letters, that very sophisticated software and computer algorithms search for equidistant letter sequences, ELS codes. And what this means is that if you begin with a letter, pull that letter from the text, and go a specific number of letters to the next, say 10 letters to the next, and you pull that letter, and then you go 10 letters to the next, and pull that letter, and 10 letters to the next, and pull that letter, the letters you've just pulled say something intelligible. And where the ancients began to see this in the Bible code was with an equidistant letter sequence, an ELS, or also called a skip code of 50 letters. What they discovered was in the book of Genesis, for example, if you take the first letter of the first sentence of the book of Genesis and you go 50 letters, and then you take the next letter and you go 50 letters, and you take the next letter and 50 letters, the name Torah comes out. And the same thing happens in all but one of the other books of the Hebrew Torah. So as researchers began to do this by hand, they suspected that perhaps there may be something more complex that it would take the high-speed computers to actually work with. And this is where the statisticians and the mathematicians came together. This information now, after the assassination of Yitzhak Rabin, has been examined by some of the major universities, academic institutions, even the U.S. government, the U.S. military, and the code breakers are fascinated by how this works, although they do not understand precisely why it is only the first five books of the Hebrew Bible that allow this to work. They say that statistically, the chances of this happening by accident are over 100,000 to 1 at least, or perhaps even greater. So it is very rare to see this kind of a code in these texts. Well, when we take the code of all these Hebrew letters, the way that the information comes to us is that the names of specific individuals or events will cross over, overlap one another. So in the example of Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin, his name was discovered in the Bible code, spelled exactly as it is today. Crossing his name was actually the name of the man who assassinated him. His name was Amir, A-M-I-R, and it said in the text that the assassin will assassinate Yitzhak Rabin. It's very clear, and I'm sharing this degree of clarity to show that it's not very general, nebulous kinds of information. These are specifics. This particular prediction actually went on to tell the street name and the nearest cross street of where this assassination would occur. Well, one of the things that makes the Bible code so very, very interesting is that as it looks into our future, and by the way, it goes several hundred years into the future of where we are right now, for me, that's the good news. It means that we have a future for many hundreds of years from now, in very close proximity to some of the most frightening predictions that the Bible code can ever share is a grouping of words that I believe have deep, profound, and lasting implications. Near some of the frightening predictions of asteroids colliding with Earth, or major earthquakes unfolding upon our world, or disease epidemics where we lose much of the world's population, all these we find in the Bible code, and near every one of those are these four key words. Will you change it? Will you change it? The Bible code 3,000 years ago somehow is implying to those in a future time who would have the understanding to be able to read the code that somehow we are participating. We have something to do with which of these possibilities unfolds. None of them ever need to come to pass. The frightening possibilities and the predictions of suffering and loss of life never need to come to pass. Well, this has opened up another door of possibilities to quantum science and researchers. They said, how can all these possibilities exist at the same time? Let's do an experiment. They went back with the assassination of Yitzhak Rabin. It said that if he toured and gave a speech on a particular time of day in a particular city with a certain driver and he crossed on a certain street, that he would lose his life. They said, let's enter a query into the Bible code. What would happen if he hadn't have given his speech on that day? And the Bible code came back, and it says almost the same thing. It says that the prime minister is still assassinated, however the assassination is delayed, implying that somehow the Bible code is accounting for that eventuality or that possibility as well. And they've done this again and again. Regardless of which possibility they enter, the Bible code accounts for it. To make a long story very brief, obviously there's much, much more we could share regarding the Bible code. It appears, if it is what statisticians, mathematicians, and researchers believe it is, it may function as a massive ancient cosmic simulator, allowing us to witness future consequences for choices that we make in the present. Implying in an ancient document over 3,000 years old that somehow we have something to do with how these events play out in our lives, that somehow we are participating in what these events are saying to us. It is less about us imposing change upon the world around us, perhaps, and more about us recognizing that there are many possibilities that exist and choosing which possibility we would like to see in our personal lives, because we all have personal prophecy, as well as our collective lives, because we have a global prophecy that we are living as well. As researchers ask the question, do we know how to choose? Do we even know how to choose? The Bible code, once again, suggests that perhaps that we have in fact chosen in the past and did not even know it. There is a specific place in the Bible code, the Hebrew year 5756, which is 1996. It says that in that year, tremendous changes could be expected upon the earth. Changes of the earth's crust, earthquake, perhaps warfare. And as we know, those things did not play out the way they were predicted. Many have speculated that perhaps we transcended those changes. Well, the Bible code says something very interesting. In the year 1996, it says the people of the earth changed time. It says that we changed time, implying that perhaps we have in fact transcended some of our most frightening prophecies and have now made that quantum leap onto a path where none of them need to play out. The question is, if we did this collectively, how did we do it? Maybe we did it and we don't even know. Maybe we make these changes at each moment in our lives and we're not aware of it. If we can become aware of this power that lives within us and consciously make the choices and bring them to bear in our lives, then perhaps, at long last, we may in fact avert the greatest tragedies ever to face humankind, tap into that power that heals our bodies and brings a lasting peace into our world. This is the power of understanding the Bible code, the role of prophecy in our lives, and what quantum science now says about each of those today. In the Shrine of the Book Museum in Jerusalem, a beautiful display dedicated to the scrolls that were found in those first caves in the early days of the Dead Sea Scrolls discovery. We find perhaps one of the most telling texts that sheds light and tremendous insight into our role and our responsibility at this point in time. In the very center of the Shrine of the Book Museum is one of the first scrolls that was found by the Bedouin boy in 1946, the great Isaiah scroll. The scroll is unfolded and displayed on a vertical cylinder that stands in the center of this museum. Now, this scroll, the great Isaiah scroll, is the only scroll of all of the Dead Sea Scrolls, of all 800 scrolls and over 25,000 fragments that were discovered. This is the only scroll that was found completely intact, and it is the single most complete copy of the words of the Old Testament prophet Isaiah. It's the most complete copy that we have today. And this scroll is believed to be so precious that the entire cylinder upon which it is displayed is designed to retract vertically into the floor of the museum, into a concrete and steel reinforced vault with iron doors that close over it to protect this scroll in the unlikely event of a nuclear attack, because it is believed to be that precious. What could be on this scroll that has survived so long that could mean so much to us? Why is it that so much of this information, even today, is just now being released into the public forum where we can see these things with our own eyes? Well, we know that the great Isaiah scroll, in its completeness, says to us what many other ancient texts and traditions suggest as fragments. Because this scroll is so complete, it can be used as a template to help us understand, for example, Native American traditions, Native American prophecy, Hopi prophecy, Egyptian prophecy, Mayan prophecy, and many of the other ancient views into our time and history. The completeness of the Isaiah text allow us to use it precisely as a template to explore the mysteries of our ancient sciences of prophecy and prayer. Isaiah was the first of the great Old Testament prophets. He acknowledges in the words of his time the nature and the direction of time. In his own words, he says, "Let them come near and foretell to us what it is that shall happen," saying that there are those that can tell us what will happen in the future. Then he says, "What are the things of long ago? Tell us what happened in the past. Tell us that we may reflect on them and know their outcome." This is Isaiah, in the words of his day, speaking to a people that he could only imagine in his dreams. In the only language of his day, he was sharing something with us. Now, in what I believe are perhaps the most telling words, and I've never seen anything like this in any text or any scroll I've ever seen before, Isaiah, I believe, acknowledges that there's a good possibility the people of his future may see his words and not understand what he has said. In his own words, he says, "For you, the revelation has become like the words of a sealed scroll, when it is handed to one who can read with the request, 'Read this.' The one replies, 'I cannot. It is sealed.'" I believe what Isaiah was saying to us may be precisely what has happened since the discovery of his scroll in 1946. What he's saying is there may be those who can read the letters and know the words that are in the text very well, language experts on the one hand. On the other hand, he says, they cannot read it because it's sealed. Do they understand the meaning? Do they know what they have read? Without the insights of 20th century quantum physics, how could we? Without our insights of vertical time and time existing as many layers and many possibilities playing out, how could we understand what Isaiah was saying to us? And I believe he was acknowledging that there may be those who could read his words and perhaps not understand what it was he was saying until the time was right. Perhaps one of the most controversial aspects of Isaiah's text is known as the Apocalypse of Isaiah. And it's interesting to me because for so many people, the word apocalypse conjures up a sense of gloom or darkness, when in essence, the word apocalypse is taken from the Greek word apokalypsis, and it simply means to disclose or reveal. And that's all it means. All Isaiah was doing in his apocalypse was disclosing or revealing for us what he had seen in our time and our future. And I'd like to share some excerpts, and these are some of the excerpts that are so controversial, because historically scholars have read these excerpts and they have interpreted them in a very traditional manner. I'd like to explore these together, and then let's reinterpret them through the eyes of quantum physics in a new way that sheds new light and a very empowering impossibility that offers hope for our time, our families, our communities, and a future perhaps that we've only dreamed of in the past. In chapter 24, Isaiah looks into his future, into our future at the time of the great change of the earth. He says, "The earth at this time is utterly laid waste. It's utterly stripped." He said the earth is polluted because of its inhabitants. The inhabitants have transgressed the laws of nature, the laws of creation. We've violated the statutes, broken what he calls the ancient covenant. He goes on to say that in the great cities, nothing remains but ruin. He looks around as he was taken from his time ahead of our time to witness this possibility. He says that the foundations of the earth will shake. The earth will burst asunder. The earth will be shaken apart. The earth will be convulsed. And the moon will blush and the sun will grow pale. Now, obviously, this sounds like a very frightening time, a very frightening experience. These are the kinds of prophecies that so many people latch onto when they speak of the great prophecies of our future, whether it's Edgar Cayce or Nostradamus, the prophet Enoch, and all of these we spoke of in other programs, so I won't go into detail with them here. So this is what Isaiah sees as a possibility for our future now. Here's the key. In the same moment of time in our future, Isaiah sees something very different. Listen to this. He says, in the same moment of time, he sees a possibility where streams will burst forth in the desert, where the burning sands will become pools and thirsty ground, springs of water. He sees a time where sorrow and mourning flee from the peoples of the earth. He sees the desert and the parched land exulting, flowers blooming in the desert, and he says the eyes of the blind will be opened, the ears of the deaf will be cleared. He sees a very joyous time in the same instant in the future that he is seeing the times of catastrophic destruction. How can that be? And this is what scholars say. Scholars without the understanding of quantum time and the vertical nature of time say, which is it? Did this prophet see a time of gloom and destruction, or did he see a time of joy and healing? This is the pattern. Prophecies historically have been believed to forecast the bad times before we get to the good times. In other words, they've been interpreted in a linear fashion. When the prophet describes what they see, the prophecies have been interpreted as describing destruction, suffering, loss of life, followed by a time of peace and healing. The challenge is that although historically scholars have viewed prophecies in this way, could they be showing us something a little different? Could the prophecies be showing us a range of many possibilities rather than a linear sequence of events that would happen in our lives? I personally believe this is precisely what prophets were trying to convey to a people in their future in the only language they knew. And I'm so in awe. And I look at us today in the very sophisticated technological world within which we live and the technological language that we have, and still, how do we find the words to convey these concepts to one another today? And I'm in even greater awe of how the words of a prophet over 2,000 years ago have remained so meaningful to us today. What I believe that Isaiah was showing to us, rather than a linear prophecy where we go through a time of decline, suffering, and death, and then into a period of peace, healing, and life, I believe that Isaiah and many other prophets were saying that we are standing on the precipice, at the crossroads of this key moment in time, and we are looking into our future at all of the possibilities, this vertical array, vertical time, many, many, many ribbons of possibilities that run the gamut from death, suffering, and decline to peace, healing, and life. All of them are possible rather than having to experience one before the